This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. People dismayed that the Louisville, Kentucky officers who shot Breonna Taylor have not been charged with her death and vowed to persist in their fight for justice. Many took to the streets in several U.S. cities to call for reforms to combat racist policing. The big question for a town torn apart by Taylor's death and the larger issue of racism in America was how to move forward. Protesters chanted her name and flooded the streets in Taylor's hometown Thursday night. Several people have been detained. The U.S. government has put the first black inmate to death since the Trump administration this year resumed federal executions after a nearly two-decade pause. 40-year-old Christopher Viola was pronounced dead shortly before 7 p.m. EDT Thursday. He was convicted and sentenced to death in the slaying of a religious couple visiting Texas from Iowa when he was 19. He is the seventh federal execution since July and the second this week. Five of the first six were white, a move critics argue was a political calculation to avoid uproar. The sixth was Navajo. Viola's lawyer, Susan Otto, has said that race played a role in landing her client on death row in the 1999 killings of Todd and Stacy Bagley, who were white. Now more than 981,000 people have died from COVID-19 globally, and there are more than 32.1 million confirmed infections. South Korea on Friday said that it would impose tighter restrictions during the autumn holiday weeks when people traditionally reunite with families, flagging the risk of new clusters of coronavirus infections. The new curbs apply to at least 11 high-risk facilities in the densely populated Seoul metropolitan area, including nightclubs and bars. This is VOA News. Several Midwestern states are now reporting new spikes in coronavirus cases and expressing concerns about hospital space. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
There are new warnings about hospital capacity in Springfield, Missouri, with nearly 1,600 new COVID cases reported Wednesday, more than 100,000 infections since Missouri reopened in June, and Governor Mike Parson, a mask opponent, and his wife are among them. South Dakota has a new record high, 463 cases and 8 more deaths, despite Governor Kristi Noem declaring the virus had already peaked and promoting tourism in her state. Iowa schools sent hundreds of students home after coronavirus outbreaks. Montana, with a record high, some 500 cases are linked to schools reopening. Meanwhile, Florida's governor is calling for a college student's bill of rights, denouncing university officials for disciplining students for attending large parties. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Health authorities in China's eastern city have found a coronavirus contamination on some packages stored by a seafood importer. About two of its handlers tested positive for the virus but displayed no symptoms. China has stepped up checks on frozen food imports and banned those from some foreign meat processing plants amid the global pandemic. Thursday's results came during a routine to the company's staff, although none of the two affected men's 147 close contacts tested positive. The importer's products and facilities generated about 51 positive test results, but no tainted products made to market. The commission said without identifying the items or their origins, Chinese customs have threatened a week suspension of imports from companies whose frozen food products test positive for the virus, with third-time offenders subject to 4 weeks. Pro-democracy Hong Kong politicians staged a brief protest in the city's legislature on Friday to call for the release of 12 activists arrested by Chinese authorities at sea last month as they tried to flee to Taiwan by boat. Chinese police have said the 12, who were all suspects of crimes in Hong Kong related to anti-government protests that erupted last year, were suspected of illegal border crossing. China's foreign ministry has called them separatists. Their detention in the South Chinese city of Shenzhen has become a lightning rod for criticism of Hong Kong's Beijing-backed government. Hong Kong's government has said that it cannot interfere on their behalf and they must face legal proceedings in China before they can come home, though it says it is willing to provide feasible assistance to their families. Via remote, Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 25th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Mali's transition of president and vice president will be inaugurated today, Friday.
People can't wait for this to happen so that the ECOWAS can release the sanctions. And according to the sanctions, they said as soon as the president is sworn in, the sanctions will be lifted by the ECOWAS.
Thousands in northern Mozambique face hunger as conflict there escalates. The Kenyan government is sued for alleged killings and rights violations by police. And Cameroon journalists called for the unconditional release of their jailed colleagues.
We have strongly condemned the arrest of our colleagues who went out to report the protest, and they were picked up arbitrarily and detained. This is terrible for our democracy.
COVID-19 restrictions and poverty intersect in Ghana's second-hand clothing market. And Zimbabwe's Rescue Wildlife joins Jerusalem Dance Challenge. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Mali, former Defense Minister Bad Ndao is scheduled to be installed as the country's transitional president today, Friday. Colonel Assimi Goïta, the leader of the military junta that toppled former President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta's government, is also expected to be inaugurated as vice president. The new government will lead the country for the next 18 months before handing over to a democratically elected government. Friday's inauguration is likely to satisfy the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, which had made the installation of the transitional leadership a prerequisite to lifting sanctions that it imposed on Mali. VOA's Peter Clotty spoke with Salif Tigana, the CEO of Tigana Technology, about Friday's inauguration.
According to the sources that I talked to, most of them will say that people are just can't wait for this to happen so that the ECOWAS can release the sanctions. And according to the sanctions, they said it's going to be automatic. As soon as the president is sworn in, the sanctions will be lifted by the ECOWAS. And also there was a survey going on asking the Malian people what they think of the president that was chosen. Majority of people are satisfied with the choice.
Have Malians accepted the fact that within the next 18 months, this transitional leadership will organize an election and hand over to a legitimately elected president?
Yeah, but there are some people who are not happy with the process of designating the president of transition. And that example is M5. M5 has publicly said that they were not happy with the process. Although they did not condemn it or reject the president, but they have said that the fact that they were not involved in decision making, that is something that frustrates them. But so far, they did not say we don't want that president. People are now looking forward for the president to be sworn in and choose the prime minister and see what will be the following.
So did the M5 say what they are going to do next, since they are not happy?
Yeah, the spokesman from M5 has publicly spoken about this, and he said they were not happy by the process. The military chose to designate the president, but he did not say what would be the following actions if, in case they didn't come back or maybe choose somebody else or to involve them in decision-making. Probably, I don't know, they want to do something. They express situation. Even the imam himself has expressed some of the regret because M5 was not involved on choosing the president.
Are Malians enthusiastic or happy about having a new transitional leader that would hand over in the next 18 months for elections, both parliamentary and presidential, to be held?
Yeah, I think the majority of Malians are happy because, you know, a lot of Malians were expecting the president of transition to be a military. Most Malians would say we want a military to be in the transition.
What has been the reaction of supporters of the former president who was toppled by the military?
Yeah, that's something very weird because they are very happy with the choice. So people are like shocked to see, okay, now they are complacent with the guru, like someone who toppled their president, and now they're happy with them. But the reason is very simple, because they don't want to see someone from M5 to be a president, to be a person of transition. So they're happy. Someone who's not a politician, who's not in the other side.
Salif Tigana is the CEO of Tigana Technology of Mali. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clote from the Malian capital, Bamako. Cameroon's Journalism Association has called on authorities to stop harassing reporters and to immediately and unconditionally release journalists who were detained while covering Tuesday's opposition protests. Police incarcerated at least 8 journalists covering the anti-government protest, searched the homes of 4 of them, and seized or destroyed their equipment. While most were released yesterday, Thursday, press groups called the detentions illegal. Moki Edwin Kizeka reports from Yaoundé.
Tad Jarvis Mai, a freelance journalist, returned Thursday to his office in the English-speaking southwestern Cameroon town of Boya. Mai says he was arrested by police in the French-speaking coastal city Douala on Tuesday while reporting on protests against President Paul Biya. He spoke via a telephone call from Boya.
The man in uniform asked why am I using my phone to film them. I said, yeah, I'm on a Skype call. So they took us to that brigade in Bonaberry. One drinking alcohol, poured the whiskey on me, asked me to drink, and it just poured on my head. We're in an airtight cell. We cell for about 2 people, we're 15 in all. With no food, our phones were confiscated. They took everything from us.
Mai said he was forced to sit on the ground for 7 hours. He said he was released Wednesday at 6 p.m. after pressure from journalism associations and several international rights groups. Jude Viban, president of the Cameroon Association of English-Speaking Journalists, says Mai was arrested with 7 other reporters in the capital Yaoundé and Douala. Viban says he strongly condemns the illegal detention of journalists in Cameroon.
We have strongly condemned the arrest of our colleagues who went out to report and not to support the protest. And they were picked up arbitrarily and detained in facilities without communication, without access to their lawyers, without access to their colleagues. This is terrible for our democracy. And unfortunately, it keeps happening.
On Thursday, the National Syndicate of Cameroon Journalists reported that the homes of 4 journalists were searched by police. The report said phones, recorders, and computers were seized. Rights activist Andel Ben Vomo says Cameroon is becoming notorious for its abuses on the rights of journalists.
Est-ce que c'est normal alors que ces journalistes soient interpellé de façon violente?
He says it is very wrong for the police to violently brutalize, beat, and give corporal punishment to journalists who are simply doing their job of informing the people. Cameroonian police and the Minister of Territorial Administration did not react to the accusation when contacted by VOA. The Committee to Protect Journalists said Thursday that police are still holding one of the arrested journalists, Ludovic Ndiou. The Committee to Protect Journalists said it has not forgotten what happened to journalist Samuel Wazizi, who died in police custody in August 2019, but whose body has yet to be seen. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The United Nations World Food Programme says northern Mozambique's volatile Cabo Delgado province is facing hunger crisis as escalating conflict forces thousands to flee their homes and abandon farms. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
An armed insurgency in Mozambique's oil-rich northern province of Cabo Delgado has displaced more than 300,000 people since 2017. As fighting has intensified in recent months, thousands have fled to neighboring Tanzania, raising fears of a regionalization of the conflict. Most of the displaced have no means to feed themselves, and WFP spokesman Thompson Feary says many are totally dependent on international food aid for survival.
We know that Cabo Delgado is a farming area. This is a region that produces both crops for commercial as well as for the subsistence of the farmers there. And we know that when there is violence and if a farmer is not guaranteed that he will be there to harvest, they hardly put any seed into the ground.
The WFP plans to send food aid to reach 310,000 people in Cabo Delgado, Nampula, and Niassa. But it notes insecurity, poor infrastructure, and restrictions imposed by the COVID-19 pandemic and lack of money are threatening the operation. Fieri says the agency urgently requires $4.7 million a month to assist the internally displaced. He tells VOA the WFP will be forced to cut back on rations as early as December if it doesn't receive the needed funds. This, he adds, will have serious consequences.
When you cut rations, the adults, particularly the mothers in the families, they start skipping meals. They start reducing the meal portions in order to stretch whatever resources are available for the children to have something. So we are also concerned because Cabo Delgado has very high malnutrition rates.
Cabo Delgado has the second highest rate of chronic malnutrition in the country, with more than half of children under age 5 chronically malnourished. The UN agency has enough money in its coffers to feed the internally displaced over the next couple of months. The WFP, however, warns it may be forced to suspend its life-saving operation if the funding shortage persists beyond the end of the year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Bata in Washington. Today is Friday, September 25th. Four human rights groups in Kenya are suing the government over alleged killings and human rights violations by Kenyan police as they enforced a curfew to stop the spread of the coronavirus. The rights groups are seeking legal reforms and monetary compensation on behalf of victims. Rael Ombuor reports from Nairobi.
The rights groups Amnesty International Kenya, International Justice Mission Kenya, Haki Africa and Kituo cha Sheria says police use the nighttime curfew to violate the rights of victims at a critical time. Annette Mbogo is executive director of Kituo cha Sheria, also known as the Legal Advice Center. She explained the decision to sue the government.
Within the pandemic, that's when the government responsibility towards its people should be even higher than when things are just as normal. During this time, there was a much higher responsibility of the police to ensure that they protect as opposed to meeting violence against the citizenry. So we feel that the issues being brought in this case are unique in that respect.
The petition included demands for long-term legislative reform aimed at addressing cases of alleged police brutality in the country.
This is not the first time that these incidents have been happening. What is different in this particular case is that, one, we are not just seeking an administrative decision, but we are seeking a court decision, a declaratory decision from the court that spells out the importance of the police not using excessive force as they execute their mandate. Number two also is that we are asking the court to ensure that there is one particular department or a cabinet secretary who will be assigned with implementing the legislation that relates to protection of the citizenry from excessive force.
The petitioners include five family members of people who were allegedly killed by police during curfew enforcement. One of them is Hussein Moyo Molte, whose son, 13-year-old Yasin Moyo, was shot on the balcony of his house in Nairobi's Kiamaiko neighborhood in March. Duncan Diema, the police officer who allegedly killed Yasin, pleaded not guilty to murder charges and was later released on cash bail pending trial. Yasin's father says he hopes he will get justice through the trial or possibly through the lawsuit. He said, "What we are looking for is justice. I have not seen an officer come to me and tell me that they are on my side. I am working with those holding my hand. The case may or may not succeed, but the most important thing is that we are standing and demanding for justice." In June, The Independent Policing Oversight Authority, IPOA, a government institution that watches the work of the police in Kenya, said there had been 15 deaths linked to police action during curfew enforcement since March. Nairobi human rights activist Rama Wako says the number could be higher. She says, we have filed so many cases such as this in the past. He has since moved fast because of the media attention and involvement from rights bodies. Because of that, there is a chance that there might be justice, but we have so many cases where we do not always have the media and others on board. In such, justice is always a challenge. In recent months, Kenya's government has relaxed most of the country's coronavirus restrictions and shortened curfew hours. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
A Ghanaian artist has been documenting the journey of secondhand clothing imported in Ghana and the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on those who rely on this trade. Authorities say they are reinforcing a ban on imported secondhand undergarments due to fears that the clothing could further stress public health. But some Ghanaians say the prohibition further impacts livelihoods already strained due to the pandemic. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
Multimedia artist Sal Kofiga documents the many hands that imported second-hand clothing and fabrics pass through in the bustling Kantamanto market in Accra, which largely deals with goods discarded by the West.
In this process of distribution, you get people who are carrying these goods on their shoulders and then on their heads to warehouses, to shops and all these things. And then we have people who pull the bills on trucks and then distribute them to other places. So before the shirts even or the dress even gets to the unknown person who is coming to buy it, there is a lot of work that goes into it. And that is where I am more like interested in trying to see how these things affect people.
Kofiga's work focuses on the complex challenges within the market, including people's livelihoods and the excess production the market represents. Prior to the pandemic, American NGO The Orr Foundation estimated about 15 million items arrived weekly and that about 40% ended up discarded. That means, aside from the livelihoods this trade supports, Ghana is burdened with discarding what the West doesn't want. The coronavirus, which causes the COVID-19 disease, has had a major impact here. Fewer imports are coming in and buyer demand has decreased. Those who live on daily wages are especially vulnerable. They have been reliant on NGOs and charitable support to survive, market worker Abdullahi Rukaya says.
Because of the COVID, the business come down. Even I have a child. Even the whole of the day, if I don't get something, how can my child feed?
While those in the market wait for work to pick up again, there are concerns over a clampdown on some items after authorities said they were reinforcing an existing ban over fears some imports could spread diseases. Legislation banning secondhand undergarments, mattresses and sanitary wear took effect in 1994 due to health fears and concerns Ghana was being used as a dumping ground. But some of these items can still be found in the markets. A Ghana Standards Authority officer said porous borders are partly to blame, but added the current clampdown has led to a huge reduction in these items. NGO People's Dialogue on Human Settlements says there are negative implications for bans like this for those who rely on selling these goods and those who buy them due to their cheaper price. Abdul Muhib Salifu, a program manager at the NGO, says focusing on upgrading the market would be more useful and believes people have always been careful to wash anything bought from the market.
The informal economy, we like it or not, plays a very big role in government's management of economic situations. So sometimes when politicians try to raise, they just see one law somewhere and then they ask them and they say, that law, it bans these people from this. We are going to enforce it. You can't enforce laws when you don't create alternatives.
For his part, artist Kofiga also turns fabrics from the market into upcycled clothes, which he hopes will inspire a greener global fashion industry. Kofiga says he doesn't want secondhand garment imports into Ghana to cease, but that he just wants to highlight the excessive waste fast fashion creates and to inspire people to have a better appreciation for what still has some use. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
As the dance challenge known as Jerusalem spreads across Africa, staff at the Zimbabwe Sanctuary for Rescue Wildlife have seen their online dance video with elephants, giraffes, and other animals go viral. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
Those are officials at the Zimbabwe Wildlife Rescue Center, Wild is Life, joining in the Jerusalem Dance Challenge, a South African internet craze sweeping the continent. The song Jerusalem by South African DJ and record producer Master KG and vocalist Nomcebo went viral during the coronavirus lockdown. Dancers, both professional and amateur, began posting their performances to the song online, including with some wildlife. Roxy Dankwes, the founder of Wild Is Life, says they use their phones to record the video. Dankwes says they made the video just to ease lockdown boredom with their employees.
I think, you know, we've already had an amazing response. We didn't expect that to happen at all, that it would go viral. And yeah, I hope that it'll spread further and get more people involved in the challenge. But really, it's about, for us particularly, just spreading awareness of animals and the sentience of animals and the importance of animals for our national heritage, basically, for our children and for our country.
Dankwes says she hopes it will help support Zimbabwe's wildlife tourism industry. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
For Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with Patrick Seeling, Kenyan long-distance runner who has been banned for 3.5 years for fleeing from anti-doping officials who are trying to collect a sample. Patrick Seeling is the latest in a long line of Kenyan athletes to be sanctioned in recent years, including 2008 Olympic 1,500 meters champion Asbel Kiprok, former Boston and Chicago marathon winner Rita Jepto, and 2016 Olympic marathon champion Jemima Sumgong. The Athletics Integrity Unit Global Disciplinary Body said in a statement that Patrick Seeley ran away from anti-doping personnel, and an independent witness confirmed he huddled a fence to escape from the compound in Kapsabet in West Kenya on December 18th, 2019. In the meantime, Athletics Kenya has shortlisted 54 athletes for Saturday's dry run ahead of the Kipkino Classic due October 3rd at the Nyayo National Stadium. Athletics Kenya Senior Vice President Paul Mutui said the test events will involve 200 meters, 400 meters, and 800 meters, both men and women, and 4x400 meters mixed relay races. And now to Uganda, where a mobile telecommunications firm has awarded Joshua Cheptegei with $33,000 following his record-breaking performance at last month's Diamond League meeting in the French municipality of Monaco, where he set a new 5,000 meters world record of 12 minutes 35.36 seconds, breaking Kenenisa Bekele's 16-year-old world record of 12 minutes 37.35 seconds. Joshua Cheptegei, while receiving his award, said government should focus on building sports infrastructure in Uganda to encourage future record breakers.
We need to invest more in the sport. We need to invest more in the infrastructure. If we can have different stadiums, playgrounds across the country developed well, we will really make Uganda a tourism destination in the years to come.
In wrestling, President of Nigeria Wrestling Federation, Daniel Igale, is seeking the support of the Nigerian government to become the first black African in the United World Wrestling Bureau. Daniel Igale believes Nigeria has not done well in sports politics and is hoping that if Nigeria secures the seat, it will be a huge boost to the development of wrestling in the country and on the continent.
One of the things Nigeria hasn't done very well is in sports politics. What we're trying to do is to get into the bureau so that we can also have the necessary support for African wrestling and for Nigeria particularly. I think my being there will immensely benefit not only Nigeria but Africa.
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, September 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.